They set my friend inside my cell. And I said, get out, man, because you know they're going to write us up. You ain't supposed to be in here. But the look on his face, and I just knew something was wrong. And I'm like, hey, man, what's up? Like, is everything okay? And he just said, I got some bad news. I said, what's the news? And they said, man, you ain't going to be able to go home. And I'm like, what you mean I ain't going to be able to go home? And he said, they wanted me to come and talk to you because they don't know how you're going to respond. And so by then, I'm like, hey, get out of my room. Like, nah, I ain't got time for this. And so I became angry at him. You know, he's just a messenger. Then I just started tearing stuff up in my room. And that's when the guards ran in there. And they said, just calm down, calm down, calm down. And that's when I screamed. I said, man, get me out of here. I said, because if you don't get me out of here, get me out of this facility. I said, I promise you. I said, some bad things are going to happen.
Hey, all, this is Rasul Berry. Thanks for joining me on Where You're From. This week, I want to share my conversation with Jermaine Wilson. Jermaine is an ordained minister, husband, and father of five. Having been incarcerated for 7 years, Jermaine now serves as the mission ambassador for Prison Fellowship. And get this, is the former two-time mayor of Leavenworth, Kansas. You can find out more about Jermaine and Prison Fellowship by clicking the links in the show notes or by visiting whereyourfrom.org. That's whereyafrom.org. Please join me as I ask Jermaine Wilson, where you're from?
Leavenworth, Kansas, Midwest.
Okay. Now, that city and that name, what does that mean to you, and tell us what it means to be raised in Leavenworth?
So to me, it means a city of a second chance that provide opportunities for individuals who's been incarcerated. To some who may not be familiar with Leavenworth because they never lived here and they only heard the stories in the movie, it's associated with the military and the prisons. We got quite a few prisons in Leavenworth.
Got you. Got you. And I had to actually, you know, look this up because I'm like, I don't think there's another city that I so closely associate with prisons than Leavenworth, and discovered that one of the reasons why is because it was essentially one of the first ever federal prisons that existed, built in 1903. And that also, it's not just the civilian prison, but you also have a military prison there.
Correct.
As well. So how does the shadow of that reality of the prison system impact the everyday person just growing up in Leavenworth?
Well, it's just knowing that the prisons is part of our community. Okay. There are so many people that have moved into Leavenworth because they wanted to be closer to their loved ones that's incarcerated. And so we don't shy away from prisons being in our community. It's just one small part of our DNA.
Got it. Got it. Okay. So walk us through, what was family like for you? Where are you in the birth order? All of that.
So I was born in a small town called Kennett, Missouri.
Okay.
Boot Hill, hometown of Sheryl Crow. All right. So, you know, my dad had been to prison. He was in and out of the system, heavily involved off into drugs. And my mom, she was 15 when she had her first child, dropped out of school. By the age of 21, she had her fourth child, which was me. And my mom just wanted a different life for us. And I had an uncle who was serving in the military at Leavenworth. And he had informed my mom about Leavenworth, which was 8 hours away from my hometown I was born in. And so my mom put us all in her station wagon and drove us 8 hours. And we moved off into government housing. And we didn't realize how dangerous it was at that time. But my mom just wanted a new location, new scenery, and a new start.
Wow. Okay. 8 hours. How old were you at the time?
So when I moved to Leavenworth, I was 5 years old.
Do you remember any of that?
I just remember the fights, the screams, the arguments, and just those vague memories.
Between your mom and your dad, you mean?
Yeah, and then hitting the highway and not knowing the truth or really why we were moving.
And that's something that a lot of times kids even internalize to maybe blame themselves. How did you, as you were growing up, think about and interpret that split in that separation, and who was your dad to you?
Yeah. So my dad was always my hero. And although, you know, he was in and out in the first early stages, he came back into the picture. And so I was very happy that he was there because he was the protector, the provider. I just didn't realize he brought along his addictions, which had an impact on our entire family. And, you know, it showed every single year we had to move. The homeowner wouldn't renew the lease. Each year I got to start over, go to a new school, try to make new friends, and didn't know at that time how much of his addiction had a detriment on our family. And it was causing a divide with my mom, my dad, and also my siblings as well.
Wow. Did you even know that he was addicted at that time? Or
I didn't. Yeah. I was the baby boy.
Yeah,
literally, you know, kept everything hidden away from me.
Got you. Which is appropriate and helpful in one sense, because you don't need to see that and experience that. But in another sense, I can imagine it just adds to this sense of confusion about what's happening and why are we moving so frequently. What was some of the impact on you of moving so frequently, like in terms of making friends or interacting with school, that type of thing?
It was a struggle trying to fit in just due to my height. You know, I'm 5'2", so I was, you know, way shorter back in the day. I was always the last ones to get picked on the, you know, basketball, football, kickball, man, even foursquare, you know what I mean? I was always the one that had to wait on the sideline, and it was a struggle. Go to a different school, and then I have to reinvent myself so people can accept me for who I am. But by that time, you know, it takes a year to really get established. I'm moving on to another school. And so it was frustrating, discouraging, and I was always disappointed every single year.
And brother, I can relate to that. Let me tell you something. I was the shortest person in my class from kindergarten all the way up to ninth grade. And then from then, I was the shortest boy in my class from ninth grade till I graduated.
Yeah, man.
So I know the struggle is real, right?
I'd like to say that my mama, she cursed me with this nickname because she called me too short. And she said she thought I was going to be a midget. And so literally from the age 3 years old and up, they called me too short. Teachers, pastors, like that became my nickname. And it was just a part of me after a while.
Okay, so what was your relationship like with your siblings?
So my big brother is the person that I always looked up to. And when we got exposed to crime and drugs at an early age, the community we grew up in said it was okay to be disrespectful, to be violent, to break the law. And he was the one that was guiding me through this journey. And he's my big brother, 2 years older than me. And I looked up to him, and he had a respect. And the respect that he had, I wanted. He was muscular. He was taller. So when he would say, jump, hey, man, how high? You know, I want to be just like you. And then my two other sisters, we were close, but my brother was the one that I was the closest to.
So at what point do you remember seeing some of what it meant to be like him, also getting involved in some activity that we now would think of as criminal activity? But at the time, you might have just been a kid just following in his footsteps.
I was 12 years old when we broke into a house, and I thought this was the coolest thing. Well, he ended up going to jail, got in fight, was getting kicked out of school, ended up going to a juvenile detention center. When he came, he was actually 12 years old.
Okay.
Yeah, he was just getting kicked out of school. But the reputation that came with that, you know, people idolized him for that. And so when he came out of the system at this time, you know, I'm trying to prove something to him. Man, I got this house we can break into. And so we go and break into the house. I didn't know nothing about, you know, crime. My brother goes down, get the stereo system. I go in the refrigerator, make a bologna sandwich. You know what I mean? And then so he runs up with this equipment. He said, we got to go. Run outside. You know, we jump on our bikes. We make it a couple blocks down the street. And then we get arrested. And that was the first time I had my encounter with law enforcement.
At 12 years old.
12 years old.
So, you know, for someone who's like not grown up in an environment like that, and I'm sure you've had time to think about this, like, help us understand how doing things that lead to such negative outcomes in someone's life end up being the things that give you the most street cred and respect in the street.
Well, I think the biggest thing is, as kids growing up, not having a lot of resources, not having any programs in the community, we create our own excitement, our own fun and thrill. It starts off not thinking that it's dangerous, but over a period of time, you start to realize you're harming people, you're hurting people, you're breaking the law, and this is illegal. But when we first start off doing it, it's the thrill, it's the excitement, it's something new, we're having fun, and then the reputation that comes along with it. So it starts off with just a habit, then it becomes a learned behavior. And then once it becomes a learned behavior, eventually it turns into addiction. And before we realize, we're caught up in this cycle of crime and drug usage. But it all started off just having fun.
One thing that you've mentioned already, like the sense of respect, the thing that might be missing is the lack of a father figure to give a different type of affirmation of what is respect. How much do you think the fatherlessness and the struggle becomes the backdrop for why this kind of antisocial behavior becomes so popular?
It's important to have your father to affirm his sons. And the toughest part is that a father who never had a father don't know what to give. He can't give something he don't have. Right. And if my father would have hugged me and embraced me and said, son, I love you, you make me proud, that would have meant the world to me. Mm-hmm. I didn't hear that. And now that I'm older, I realize he never received that. But I do it with my kids, with my son, and let him know I'm proud of him. But it really builds you up. He's speaking life into me. And that's helping me to be able to find my identity because he's my father.
Yeah. And I've seen statistics recently that have shown that as much as 62% of people who have parents that are incarcerated end up incarcerated themselves. Right. And so what we see there is this generational dynamic play out where, like you said, with that absence, you begin seeking. Okay, little sidebar. So you're 12. You're on a bike.
Yep.
You get arrested. You thought you got away. You got a bologna sandwich in the stereo. What were you thinking and feeling in that moment?
That I messed up. My heart started racing just because I seen my brother's face and said, hey, we need to get up out of here. And so I'm like, oh, what's going on? You know, one person run, we all running. I really didn't know where we were going. I'm just following him, letting him lead. And then when I seen the cops, that's when my heart just dropped.
Mm. So then what happens next?
Man, I begged that cop not to call my mama. I said, man, just leave me at JDC. Whatever you do, don't call my mama. And he said, well, you should have thought about that before you broke in somebody's house and didn't realize the neighbors had called the cops. And so I'm 12 years old, getting arrested, back in the police car, goes inside the JDC. They go through the whole fingerprint. And it's just that process. It was just like, wow, like what just happened? I'm scared. I'm nervous. And then when they called my mom, it was over. They kept my brother. And then when my mama got a hold of me, you know, like, hey, my mama, she from down south. I tell people, man, she beat me so bad, she stunted my growth. That's why I got this height deficiency.
I tell you, that it is a fascinating thing to be like in jail at Juvenile Detention Center, JDC. But still mostly thinking about the fear of your mom.
Yeah.
So they let you go. Was it just because you were young? Or?
Yeah. It was my first time ever getting in trouble. I ended up getting diversion. And so I actually had a probation officer that I would report to. And as long as I stayed clear from trouble, you know, it was going to eventually fall off my record.
And that's what happened, right? You didn't get into any more trouble. And the story ends there.
I didn't get caught at that moment. And the reason that I continued that criminal lifestyle is because when I went to school, people had heard about what had happened. Although, you know, my body was sore from the discipline, the consequences my mama gave me, that respect, that love, and that acceptance that I was looking for the first time I started to get, you know, that right there made me want to continue that criminal lifestyle. And I just became accepted by the popular crowd.
You know, that's a really interesting backstory, knowing how you shared for all those other reasons, the moving around a lot, the height disparity, all these other reasons where you weren't feeling that sense of support and acceptance. And now doing this thing gets you that. So when is the next time that you find yourself in the crosshairs of law enforcement?
At the age of 15, I ended up committing a robbery and was sentenced to 2 years in juvenile corrections, tried to escape, failed in the attempt and was sentenced to an additional 2 more years. So at the age of 15 years old, I was going to go serve 4 years in juvenile corrections.
Mm. How did that hit you differently than the first time around?
I wasn't going home. My teenage years just flashed right before my eyes. I was afraid. You know, I became hopeless at that moment. And I just wish at that moment that I could have redone things, took a different route. I was living in regret. because I knew I caused so much pain on my mom. I caused so much pain on my siblings, even my dad, because they had started going to church. They was trying to do the right thing. But by then, you know, me and my brother, we was just indulged heavily off into the street life that just became heartbreaking.
So the first time around, like you said, you're in, you're out. So now in this time, you're 15, which is still a baby, essentially. Walk us through the actual experience of now this is reality for you. What was it like to be inside?
Yeah. And so now I'm locked up in the juvenile detention center, 15 years old. I'm at this facility for 5 months. Normally, the average person would be there only 90 days because I tried to escape. I'm there for 5 months. So I'm still in my community. People coming in is just, and I'm putting on the front, acting like I'm tough. And, you know, the respect, like, man, yeah, I heard what you was doing out there, short. I mean, keep your head up. You got this time. And we're going to hold you down while you inside. And at nighttime, I'm crying myself to sleep because I just want to go home, want to go to school. And then I finally get that call at 6 o'clock in the morning. They put me on the transport bus and they ended up taking me to Atchison, Kansas, the juvenile facility up there. And now I'm with individuals who serving time. They're not going home. And so I get to this campus. It's fence, it's wires, and I'm seeing everybody in their uniforms. And I'm just like, man, I can't believe this. This is where I'm going to be for 4 years. And so I go through the intake. They give me my clothes. Then I go down to the cottage. And now I'm hearing people from Wichita, from Kansas City. I'm seeing gang tattoos. And I'm like, this is my life now. What are you going to do while you're here? And immediately I said, man, I can't be soft. Like, I got to choose sides. I got to figure something out. And at that moment, that fear set in, and that fear caused me to want to join a gang.
Mm. So what was that experience like?
Very challenging experience, because once again, now it's like I moved schools again. And I'm starting from ground zero. No one knows who I am. No one cares who I am. And so I'm having to build this reputation. I ended up joining a gang that my brother was associated with. And people knew my brother, but I had to make a name for myself. So when I joined the gang, immediately I started fighting. And I'm all proved myself, build up a reputation. And so I'm constantly fighting in and out of segregation. And it was just heartbreaking because when my mom would come up and visit me and she's just like, what are you doing? Like, who are you? This is not you. Why are you trying to prove yourself? And I would just break down and cry during visitation. And I'm just like, Mom, it's hard in here and it's tough. Like, I just want to survive.
How long were you in Atchison?
I was in Atchison, Kansas for 9 months. And then I transferred to Larned, Kansas, which was 3 hours away from Leavenworth, Kansas. I tried to play the system. They said this new facility just opened up in Larned, Kansas, drug rehab program. They said if you have a drug history, then you're eligible to attend this facility. And in reward, you're able to get a year knocked off your time. So I'm like, man, sign me up. I done lied, said I done did crack, meth, heroin, all of this. Just to sign up. And so I go through the process. And in my mind, I was going to do a year here, then transfer to Topeka, Wildcat, where my brother was serving time at, and finish out my last year there. That didn't happen. And so when I realized that we got bamboozled, I said, I think they was just trying to get us at this facility so they can fill the bed space. And then immediately, I went back into my old thinking. I'm like, okay, you know what? Since they're not going to provide us with what they promised us, I said, we're about to turn this facility upside down. And one thing that I learned, and these are for the individuals that's incarcerated, people want to know that they're being heard, seen, and valued. If you're not doing that in a positive way, well, then they're going to get that in a negative way. Because when we're tearing stuff up, guess what? Now we got your attention. Now you're able to hear us. And so that's one thing that I learned about individuals that's incarcerated. They want to be heard, seen, and valued.
That's interesting that you bring that up. Even in the context of incarceration, there is still a place and a value for positive reinforcement of acknowledging and honoring work that people are doing, even while they've made a bad decision to like try to better their life there. And what I'm hearing you say is that the absence of that in this place, this sense of just like you're just a number, you're just a bed space, that created a vacuum and a void where people needed to then go seek that affirmation in destructive ways.
And just know my time that even though it was challenging and I was heavily involved off in the gangs, there were still some guards and counselors that seen the potential in me. And they just said, you're not your brother. Because my brother had been to that facility too. He had been to all the facilities. And they just said, you're not your brother. Like, there's something special about you. Like, find your purpose, find who you are, and be yourself. And I used to hear this all the time. And so I'm at this facility for 2.5 years, and it's by the grace of God. I was able to get my high school diploma during this time, because while you're in juvenile corrections, like, you have to go to school all year round if you're not working. And my mom comes up during my graduation. Man, it was a very, very emotional time, because during the time my parents was up visiting me, the guards came over to my mom and said, you have an emergency at your house. My mom got on the phone and they said somebody was dead at our house. And that's when I realized my sister just had committed murder.
Mm-hmm.
And so now my brother's locked up, my sister's locked up, and I'm locked up, and find out this news while they're visiting me. And for a while, I thought it was my fault. You know, I'm like, well, if they wasn't here visiting me, then they would have been able to be at home and maybe this wouldn't have happened. And so I was holding on to that weight. I went off into an emotional stage and I just really started to isolate myself. I started taking pills just to numb the pain, became addicted to the prescription during my time of incarceration. And I was just at a very low place. And I want to say I was supposed to got out October 31st, 2005. And they had told me that I was eligible for 6 months of good time. And so I just started focusing, like, you know what? I see the light at the end of the tunnel. I'm soon to go home. 30 days before I was supposed to got released. And so I'm angry and just really, really mad. And they said it was a glitch in the system. My paperwork got messed up. And when you tell a person that he's still eligible to receive something, and then I see the light at the end of the tunnel in 30 days of me getting released, they said, Leavenworth don't want you back. They said they want you to max out your system. So the paperwork got messed up and they just said you have to complete your sentence. So they agreed to ship me to a different facility and I went to Topeka. Topeka was an hour away from my house. And I had maxed out my time there, 6 months at that last facility. The second day I was there, that old lifestyle came back. You know, I was just putting up my tray in the kitchen cafeteria. Person came up and hit me upside of the head. That old gang lifestyle, just everything just went back in full spiral.
You know, I just got to pause. I can only imagine that emotion that you felt in that cell. Yeah. First, the confusion, because you're like, I'm trying to go on the straight and narrow. This seemingly illegal visit is not going to help with that. And then to find out that it wasn't an illegal visit because the guards sent them in there to give you this message. It's hard to hear that, like, something that's a quote unquote glitch is still taking precedent over what was your sentence. Like, that just feels like, again, another way in which that's just broken. Like, you know, 30 days turns into 6 months. I can understand that frustration. And so when you say you got transferred for that last 6 months, that's when the switch goes off. You kind of go back into survival mode, but it's still 6 months. So after that, you get out?
Yeah, after the 6 months, I get out. And I went back to my old neighborhood. I went back to the people that said they were going to hold me down. And this time they welcomed me, not with open arms, but with a sack of crack cocaine. And because I had failed to plan, man, I just accepted what they were offering me. And I lost myself because I began to be like everybody else and went back into that old lifestyle.
Mm. And so now you're selling drugs and using as well?
Yes, sir. I got addicted to ecstasy and I was selling crack cocaine.
Wow. In that span of time, how is that impacting your life and even relationships?
Yeah, I bought off into the lie that nobody would hire me due to the fact that I had a criminal record, not realizing because I had a juvenile record that my record was sealed from the public, but that information wasn't disclosed to me. And so as I'm going filling out job applications, you know, I'm able
to... Wait, Paul, I'm sorry. This is just hard to wrap my head around. Nobody told you that? That seems like such an important piece of information, even just to encourage people. Like, hey, before you go back out there, you got a fresh start now because
I didn't hear
none
that.
Of this... Nobody told you any of that.
I didn't hear that. I heard the opposite. And I heard from the OGs. I heard from my peers. Hey, brother, you might as well go ahead and get that fast money because that slow money ain't going to come to you because the opportunities are not going to be there. And I settled for that. And so what I ended up doing, I went back to the thing that I learned while I was incarcerated and how to sell drugs. And because I had this anger, this animosity toward the city of Leavenworth, I literally purposed in my heart that I was going to become the biggest drug dealer in Leavenworth, Kansas, and I'm going to live it up, have fun. When they catch me, they catch me. But I got to make up this time that Leavenworth took away from me. Because I was so immature, I didn't accept my responsibilities. And I settled for that fast life instead of, you know, just becoming a productive citizen.
Wow. And so where did that get you?
I made a lot of money and I had the material things that I wanted. But deep down, I was struggling. Deep down, I was hurting and I wanted something different. I just didn't know how to get out of this system, this prison that I had created for myself in my mind and also within my heart. And I had a lot of unforgiveness toward my girlfriend at the time because I felt like she left me and abandoned me. But we were together and God blessed me with the son with her. And when he blessed me with the son, I thought that was going to change my world. But once he came out, I'm looking at him and I'm seeing myself. Immediately, I said, I got to make this happen for him. And what did I do? I used his birth as an excuse to hustle even harder.
So let me rewind back. Did you meet your girlfriend when you got out from the 6 months at the end of your previous sentence when you turned 19, or was it before?
Yeah. So I actually met her at 13 years old. So we were 13 years old.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Oh.
And so the day that I actually got locked up, she told me not to go with my brother. And I didn't listen. Yeah.
So when you talk about abandonment, you mean when you were away, you weren't hearing from her?
Yeah, those 4 years, nope. And then she had a child during that time that I was gone. So I had that unforgiveness. I had that hurt, that anger, that bitter, you know, toward Leavenworth and everybody that was in Leavenworth. Mm.
And you said that pretty much fueled even your decisions to go even harder and just kind of do, you know, what you were going to do, even with the son. And it sounded like there's a tension because on the one end, you want to be present for your son in a way that your father wasn't there for you. But on the other end, you are still wrestling with a sense of abandonment.
Yep.
So how do those two things collide together in the decisions that you end up making in this season?
I was living a life of stress because I couldn't trust anybody. And I knew I was going to go to prison. And the craziest thing is I was ready to go to prison. Hmm. And my mom, she seen me one day getting ready to hit the highway. And she just said, "You tired?" She said, "You ready to go lay down?" And I just broke down crying. I just couldn't say nothing else. And she just hugged me and embraced me. And it wasn't long after that when I actually caught a drug charge. I was with my son and his mom. And she told me, she said, "Whatever you do, don't leave this house." I was at the house packing some things up. I said, "I'm going to go take this one last trip." And when I left the house, the cops were waiting on me. And when they pulled me over, they found the drugs in the vehicle. And then that's when I got arrested.
And how old are you now?
I'm 20 now. And I was only out 18 months after I served 4 years. Got involved off in the drugs, got addicted to drugs, had a son in the process. And now I'm going back for 3 years.
How are you feeling as you are doing this latest stint?
Now that I'm in prison, man, I'm really broken. I'm broken. My mind is starting to sober up. And I just begin to ask myself questions. I'm going through the intake unit, RDU, got my prison number.
What's RDU?
Yeah, RDU is the intake. Whenever you go to prison, you actually go inside the prison to get your prison number, your picture. And then that's when they do assessment on you. They test you for your education. Then that's when they make the decision on which facility that you're actually going to go to. But during that time, 6 weeks, you're locked down 23-1.
23-1, what does that mean?
Yeah, 23 hours locked down, you get 1 hour of recreation out a day.
Wow.
Locked down 23 hours a day. And that time, that's when I really begin to think and reflect on my life. Now I'm sobered. I don't have these distractions. I'm thinking clearly and sober. And so I ask myself a question, is this the life that I want for my son? And I begin to look over my life. As my dad had been to prison. My brother was in prison, sister's in prison, now I'm in prison. Who's gonna break this cycle? Because if I don't break this cycle, my son is gonna follow in my same footsteps. do I want my son to be in prison with me? And I said, no. And that's when I made the decision to join Prison Fellowship Program. I knew that I needed to be in a community, an environment where I'm surrounded around like-minded individuals that's heading in a direction that has purpose across the finish line.
When we come back, Jermaine will share how the racial divisions he saw plaguing America drove him to take a radical step to bring unity to his community. That's coming next on Where You're From. Hey, y'all, before we get back to my conversation with Jermaine Wilson, I wanted to share a quick teaser from our next episode with Pastor Jerome Gay. This is Where You're From.
When you have to live with an addict and you see how they treat you, you see how they are when they're under the influence, you know, like this isn't the same person. They're night and day when they're not high versus when they're high. And so I remember, you know, at the time, we had this system called the Sega CD. That was like top tier, you know what I mean? Family got me that. And then coming home and he had pawned it. My Timberlands, he pawned those things. You're coming home and these things are no more. I remember we walked in and we saw that stuff was gone and my mom just broke down in tears because she knew what had happened. Wow. That this was going again towards his habit. And so when you have to live through that, you never feel a sense of stability.
Now let's get back to our conversation with Jermaine Wilson on Where You're From. What had you heard about Prison Fellowship that made it sound like this was a good step to go in this new direction?
The Brotherhood, it was a Christian environment, faith-based environment, open to all religions, but it was really founded upon Christian principles. And I just knew that I needed to be surrounded around people that was going to push me forward and not pull me down. And I know if I'm around good-minded individuals that are leaders, that understands their purpose and moving toward their purpose, then God can help me to discover my purpose as well. You know, they got classes every day helping you to identify your purpose. You're learning about Jesus Christ. And those things was encouraging, uplifting versus the gang lifestyle. That was the alternative. I definitely don't want to get caught up. Let me go ahead and make a decision and do the right thing, not just for myself, but for my family.
So your own life experiences had shown you the power of fellowship and community, even if it was going in the wrong direction.
Yep.
And so you therefore knew that fellowship and community in the right direction would even be strengthened. You said this before in a previous interview. I had accepted Christ in my cell before, but that experience of letting go of unforgiveness was my true spiritual awakening. It's why I've always got a smile on my face to this day.
Yeah.
Which you got a pretty great smile.
I appreciate it.
Tell us about that spiritual awakening of forgiveness and how that set you free.
See, one thing that I've learned, I had to be broken down and stripped away from everything I had in order for God to get my attention. And when I cried out to God, God came into my heart. I accepted Christ into my life. I started to change. I tell people that I lost my freedom, but discovered my purpose. And when God revealed to me what my purpose was in life, he was going to use me to impact the prison system, to inspire hope to so many individuals and provide second chances. I just had to go through the journey. And as I'm going through this journey and I'm learning about myself, you know, I'm a great communicator. I know how to influence people. I know how to connect with people. But there was something still deep down in my heart I didn't realize that was there until I really, really, really had to dig deep. And there was that unforgiveness that I was holding toward Leavenworth, toward my son's mom, and toward my siblings. Because I felt like the time that I needed them the most, they abandoned me. And God is showing me that these are the things that I'm holding on to in order for me to truly heal and grow. I'm holding all of this in and God is just dealing with me. And I'll never forget the day where we did an exercise. We were outside. Everybody made a big circle and there was a fire right in the middle. And the instructor had instructed everybody, write down things you need to forgive people for and then put it in the fire. And I started crying. I'm looking to my right, looking to my left. Other people are crying. And I was just like, wow. I didn't know, like, I needed this. This is healing for me. God is changing me from the inside out. And in order for me to really become who he's calling me to be, I have to let go of everything. And forgiveness was that one thing that I was struggling with. And when I put those names down, threw it in the fire, when I say peace came upon me at that moment, like I was released from all of those negative things. And that's when my life really started to blossom. That's when I really started to hear clearly from God. And that's when I truly became free while still being incarcerated.
What a transformation. Now, let me just ask you this. You had mentioned that your mom and even your dad, who had been in and out of your life, had made a faith commitment and started going to church before. How did that impact you? Or did it even hurt worse when they weren't around or reaching out as much because of their newfound faith?
Yeah. So my mom, she was my biggest supporter, encourager. Mm. And she would fast, she would pray, she would make us do it. But it built resentment toward us because I used to see her give her money to the church. We can't go to McDonald's because she never paid her tithes and offering. And so with that, you know, I felt like we didn't have a life because all the time, like if we weren't running the streets, we were made to be at church. And so I didn't realize, like, once I started searching God for myself, those seeds that she planted at an early age started to grow because the things you're exposed to will affect the way that you grow, rather it's negative or positive. Well, because she introduced me to the church at an early age, when I started going through the prison fellowship program, I'm learning about myself and learning about God. Now I'm able to develop a relationship with God. And now that I'm understanding God, I'm starting to understand myself because my identity is in Christ and not into a sack of crack cocaine, not into any type of drugs, but my identity is in Christ. And so now I'm really starting to see, like, God didn't create me to fail. God got a plan and a purpose for my life, but it took me going to prison, losing time to find better time and to have quality time with him. There's no distractions. Now I'm able to invest in myself by building a relationship with God. And that right there is the biggest investment, the best investment that I ever made.
I love how you describe good time and bad time, because that's something that Dr. Henry Cloud and Peter Townsend talk about as well. Because when people say time heals all wounds, not necessarily. It depends on what you do with that time, because time can cause you to still deepen in bitterness. It's like the question is, am I getting bitter or am I getting better? Yep. And it sounds like in that time that you had, you got better. Now you still have this son. How does that get impacted by this new faith experience?
So the beautiful thing is, and moment of my life became the greatest moment of my life, because when I let go and let God take control of all situations, God forgave me. I accepted this new walk, this new faith. I'm forgiven. I'm forgiving others. God speaks to my wife's heart, touches her heart. She gets saved, and now it brings her back into my life. And I kid you not, brother, it was the verse Malachi 2:14. And I opened my Bible. I said, God, just show me if she's the one. Verse 2:14. And it was literally talking about being with the wife of your youth. And my wife's birthday is February 14, 2:14. And so I'm just like, all right, God, you got to work this out. And when she came and visited me, I knew it was God, because in prison, literally, you only get one visit that weekend. And I just had one on Saturday. My mom and dad came up. And then when they called me on Sunday, they said I had a visit. I'm like, man, they probably got the wrong person. And then when I went up there, it was her. And then she told me about her faith. And I'm like, wow, nothing but God. And so we became friends. She brought my son up. Now I'm able to start praying with my family. You know, we're reading together. And it's just so rewarding and refreshing, because she's seeing that I've changed. And now we're able to communicate on the level where, you know, we're not just talking about worldly things, but we're talking about godly things. You looking up that scripture, ain't you?
I did. you know it, because I had to see it for myself. Okay, Malachi 2:14.
Go on and read it.
But you say, why does he not? Because the Lord was witness between you and the wife of your youth, to whom you have been faithless, though she is your companion and your wife by covenant. Wow. That's what you just turned to.
Brother, it hit me so hard. And I'm like, I'm going through what I'm going through because I was unfaithful. but you're still telling me, this is the wife of my youth. This is my companion. This is the one for me. Say, God, whatever I go through with her during the rest of this time, I'm accepting. And I said, because at the end of it, she's still going to be the one for me because you said it in your word.
Amazing. So the corner has turned. How much more time do you have to do and what happens when you get out?
Yeah, so I did a total of 3 years in prison. And once I got released from prison, I paroled to my son's mother's house. And now I'm faced with a new prison. And this prison right here, they really didn't prepare me for. I thought I was prepared for it. But honestly, this one thing I tell people, we spend so much time preparing returning citizens for society, but not enough time preparing society for returning citizens. When I got released from prison, I'm filling out job applications, ready to work, qualified to work, you know, got ambition, the desire, the skills, and now I'm getting doors shut on me every single time due to the fact of my criminal record. And so that was a struggle. And, you know, I went through this for weeks, and just was getting depressed. And I'm like, God, you said that you're going to make a way for me. When's it coming? And God literally spoke to me. No doesn't mean that you're not qualified. It just means next opportunity. And I realized I just needed that right opportunity. Well, instead of me working in Leavenworth, my son's mom worked at a dry cleaner's, which was an hour away. And that was my first job. I ended up working at that dry cleaner's, that cleaning company, making $8 an hour. It wasn't a lot, but I was thankful and grateful for that opportunity.
So you said that there's a lot of emphasis that's put on preparing formerly incarcerated people for society, but not a lot of energy put into preparing society for formerly incarcerated individuals.
Yes, sir.
I think one can understand why that box is checked there, you know, but on the other end, it seems like it creates a tighter box to put people in. What would you imagine would be a better way for society to be prepared for formerly incarcerated people?
It starts with conversations. It starts with employers stepping up, having conversations with reentry programs, just so they can get a better understanding of the individuals, who they're going to be working with, getting an opportunity to see them as not prisoners, but as people. And when they see that process that they actually go through, the classes that they take, they see that they're rehabilitated. And so therefore, it helps them to be able to understand the person and see the person rather than see the background. Because once you think that a person has a criminal record, you think the most heinous crime.
Yeah.
And so I just really think it starts with conversations. I really think it starts off with pilot programs, giving people the opportunities, opening up the door and allowing it to work.
And this is something that you didn't just talk about, but you saw a problem and decided to do something about
it. Yes, sir.
Yourself, in addition to just finding gainful employment. Tell us a little bit about that process and what you founded the nonprofit organization to help address these issues.
So I got released from prison December the 9th, 2010. Fast forward 2015, God blessed me with an opportunity to get my criminal record expunged. I got my criminal record expunged, and then I'm praying. I'm always praying and asking God, what's next? God shows me that there's been a divide throughout our nation because of the police brutality, the racism, Trayvon Martin case, the Mike Brown case. And I'm seeing how social media is really planting the seeds of division inside of people's heart. And it's really starting to affect my community as well as my siblings. Anytime that my kids would see officers, like they'll duck and act scared, I'm like, hey, what's going on? And so I seen how it was hitting home, and I prayed. I said, God, like, show me what is it that you want me to do? And I prayed, and God said, I want you to unify the community. And so, you know, when God shows you a vision, automatically, I'm about to save the world. And then that's when God says, start right at home. Before you can impact the nation, you got to start right at home. And that's when I made the decision to call up the chief of police. I said, I would like to meet with you. He's like, who's this? I said, this is Jermaine. Well, he didn't know me as Jermaine. He said, I don't know Jermaine. I said, this is Too Short. He said, oh, hey, how you doing? So by this time, you know, I got involved off into the church community. I'm serving, giving back to the community. That JDC I tried to escape from. I'm a mentor at that JDC facility. Well, I got more kids as well. And so I'm a leader with a good reputation now. So I meet with the chief of police. Him and I have a conversation, and he asks, what's going on? And I was just straightforward with him. I said, chief, we see the divide that's taking place throughout the nation. We don't want the division in our community. In order for us to be able to create change and be the solution to the problem, we have to become united as one. Law enforcement and the citizens in the community. And he said, so what do you have in mind? I said, everybody loves sports. Everybody loves barbecue. We can do a free food event, donate some clothes, and have the teams versus the police department in basketball. He said, all right, where you want to have it at? I said, the hood, which was north side of Leavenworth. He was in agreement. And he said, you know what? He said, I appreciate this. Let's work together. So when we scheduled the event, going through the process, I'm passing out flyers to people. And some people actually read the flyer and said, what's got police on it? Like, what you doing? I said, we're trying to better the community. He's, oh, no, man, I got warrants. Some people just throw the flyers back. Uh-huh. And then there was other people that said, man, we'll be there. So when the day came of the event, it was a couple of hundred people. They showed up. We had blacks. We had whites. We had the teenagers. We had the law enforcement. The fire trucks was out there. Like, the politicians showed up. And so the energy was so positive. The love was there. And, you know, the basketball game kicked off. The teenagers won the game. You know, they were more in shape than the officers was. And then I seen kids taking pictures with the officers. And then I just looked around and just thanked God, because I started seeing the smiles on everybody's face. And then at that moment, that's when people started asking, who put this event on? They said, that's that little short dude over there. They said, ain't this too short from back in the day? They said, yeah, but he's doing something positive now. And that's when people came up and started asking, you ever thought about getting involved in politics? I said, oh, no, man, that's the devil's playground. I don't do politics.
How do you end up responding to this invitation that people have and what they see in you?
So it was two callings that happened. My friend, Sean Crittenton, he was the director of the JDC that I tried to escape from. He allowed me the opportunity to be able to come back as a mentor. And he said, Jermaine, the impact that you're making on this community, one day you could possibly become the mayor. I'm like, yeah, right. And when he said that, like, literally, like, it's like a big thump in my heart. Like, God just punched me in my chest. And I was just like, then I started scratching my head. He planted that seed. A few months later, a man of God prophesied over me. And he said, God has a special calling on your life, and you're going to have the influence of politics one day. And I'm like, why does this keep coming up? And next thing you know, I'm promoting an event, and then I get connected with the politician who's actually campaigning. And him and I both are going door to door. He's campaigning. I'm promoting the event. And then he said, man, you got a skill. Like, you know how to connect with people and communicate with people. He said, man, you might have a future in politics one day. And then I just began to pray. I said, God, if this is a door that you are opening up, open this door, confirm it. I'm going to walk through this door that no man can close. I said, but God, I don't know what I'm doing. I'm trusting in you. And then when the time came for me to sign up, hey, I prayed. And I'm like, God, are you sure? And then, you know, I just got that encouragement from my wife, from my friends. And that's when I signed up and I started to go through the process.
And so what happens with that process?
So I signed up. I don't know anything about campaigning. So I Google, man, how do you campaign? What does this look like? Politicians, you know, they got a team. They're going door to door. And I'm like, but I got to be the one to go door to door because, you know, people got to see me. They got to know who I am. And so it's hot, brother. It's like in the middle of July. And when I say Kansas weather gets hot, I'm talking about over 100 degrees. And now wearing long sleeve shirts because I'm trying to cover my tattoos, trying to dress the part, trying to look like a politician. And I'm like, all right, I'm just going to knock on these doors. And I got a couple of flyers. I'm nervous. I'm scared. You know, I'm knocking on a total of 5 doors. The first 3 doors that I knocked on, man, people weren't even home. Mm-hmm. Then I get to the 4th door. The guy don't even get off the couch. He yells, ain't no way in the world I vote for you. So I'm mad, frustrated. I'm ready to kick someone on the porch. You know what I'm saying? I said, man, it's hot. He ain't even got the decency to come talk to me. Then I get on this 5th door. I knock on this door. And I'm not going to lie to you, brother. The thought's already in my mind, man, I'm the guy that been to prison that's now running for office. So this is what people know me as. And so I knock on this 5th door. I hear this girl, man, somebody's at the door. The lady comes to the door with her daughter, and brother, I got sweat pouring all down my face. And so my shirt is drenched. Caucasian lady opens up the door. Her eyes get this big. My eyes get this big. I'm scared. She's scared. I could barely get my words out. I said, vote for Jermaine. I threw my flyer and I took off running down the street, brother. And I'm like, God, like, what is going on? Like, I don't know what I'm doing. Like, are you sure this is what you want me to do? And God just literally, man, start to minister to my spirit. And he said, I never called you to be like everybody else. I called you to be yourself. When you tried to be like everybody else, you lost yourself. And I'm like, man, I'm different. Like, I have to embrace my uniqueness. And at that moment, I said, all right, God, you calling me to do it? I got to be me. I got to be myself. So everybody loved barbecue. So I got connected with the managers at Dollar Store, told them my story, told them I was running for office, wanted to serve the community, wanted to be a blessing. And they said, oh, go ahead. You can definitely put up your barbecue grill. So as customers was walking in and out of Family Dollar Store, I'm handing them a plate of barbecue. I said, you want this? They said, yeah, is it free? I said, yes, ma'am, it's free. They'll bite that barbecue. Oh my God, this is delicious. I said, vote for Jermaine. So they will fall out laughing. But then it's when they said, what's your story? So I began to share my story with them. I began to witness to them. And then some would even break down and cry and say, thank you, because I have a son that's incarcerated. He feels hopeless. And I was beginning to lose hope. But today you have given me hope. You are letting me know all things are possible. Even if you don't win, baby, this right here, you just getting to this point is success to me. So I thank you. And you do got my vote.
Wow.
And so that was my campaign speech. Man, God saved me during my time in prison. God changed me. God can use me to help change this community, create unity. There's going to be no more division, and it's going to start with me. I'll lead the way and serve on the front line.
And so now you can't leave us on that cliffhanger. What ends up becoming the results?
Man, so everybody's looking now, the newspaper, the news station, everybody that caught this story, the prisoners running for politics. On the day of the election, I was able to vote for myself because I had completed my parole. I re-registered and got my voting rights restored, and that gave me the opportunity to vote for myself. Remember, once you complete your parole, you have to re-register in order to get your voting rights restored. And so I ended up receiving the most votes, was elected as city commissioner in 2017, served as a commissioner, and then in 2019, became the mayor of Leavenworth, Kansas. And so the day that I became the mayor, it was exciting. It was overwhelming. I gave praises to my Lord and Savior, Jesus Christ. Thank my beautiful family, as well as my constituents. But I knew that God had put me in that position to be a key to unlock doors for other individuals' second chance. The second day that I was in office, I worked with the prosecutor, and we provided free expungements for people in the community that was eligible. That was a huge need because there's so many individuals that are faced with the barriers that have a criminal record. They can't find decent housing. They can't find good employment. And so it keeps them in a box because they have to check this box right beside their names. Have they been convicted of a felon? Well, they have to check that box and say yes. But with the expungement, legally, you have the right to say that you have not been convicted of a felon, and it clears and seals your background. Your criminal record is sealed.
That is amazing to think about your arc from 12 years old, getting arrested in Leavenworth, and then years later, now being the mayor. You know, what did that mean for you?
It really helped me to see, man, that God is real. God will use and choose whoever he wants to use. And God is not a respecter of a person. And he'll take the foolish things of this world to confound the wise. And the process prepares us for our purpose in life. God allowed me to go through prison because God knew I needed to sit down. I needed to be able to have that time to focus on him. The distractions needed to be removed. I needed to be broken down so he can build me up. And so that right there became true hope. That became true redemption for me because it wasn't about me. It was really the new Joseph in this season.
Yo, I was about to say,
you see what I'm saying?
Literally Joseph from the Bible, who was in prison and then goes into being second in command of all of Egypt.
Yeah. And so some people, they can read the Bible and be like, man, I know that story, you know, back in the day. Well, we got this new generation who may not open up the Bible. Well, God is using me to be a living witness, to be the Bible for those who won't crack open the Bible. And they ask this question, how did you do it? And it gives me an opportunity to point them to Jesus Christ. I said, God did this, changed my heart, changed my mind. When you serve to make a difference, the position will always come. If you serve for a position, you'll never make a difference. The impact and the change that was being created because God was using me on the front line, like it impacted the community. You can't expect what you don't invest, because I invested in my community invested back into me in a return. And God gets all the glory for that.
Amen. You know, I also see a beautiful symmetry with even knowing a little bit of the history of prison fellowship as well, with the late Chuck Colson, who, you know, was in politics. That gets him involved in the situation. He gets arrested, and it's through his prison experience that he founds prison fellowship. Yep. Now, here are you, somebody who then comes from prison to now serving in politics. It's just an incredible parallel.
Full circle.
Full circle. And in 2021, you ended up coming on staff with Prison Fellowship. Tell us a little bit more about Prison Fellowship and what you do.
Yeah, so Prison Fellowship is the nation's largest Christian nonprofit organization serving prisoners, former prisoners, and their families. The beautiful thing that I love about Prison Fellowship, because the mission is to restore those affected by crime and incarceration. The vision is to see all impacted by crime reconciled to God, their families, and their communities. We serve and meet the individuals where they're at while they're incarcerated, and then we provide programs, but also serve their families, their children, because we know that there's a disconnect. So Prison Fellowship is there to serve and to meet the needs of the men incarcerated, to help build them up with their faith, but also to help them to see that God has a plan and a purpose for your life. You're not a felon. You're not a failure. You're not a mistake. God created you on purpose, for a purpose, and God is inside the prisons already. He's here. He's meeting you where you are at. So building them up and letting them know that all things are possible to those who believe. You don't have to be hopeless, because through our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ, He gives us hope.
Wow. I want you to share a little bit about the Angel Tree program and then also how people can get involved either with that or Prison Fellowship in general.
So Angel Tree program is a program of prison fellowships that serves incarcerated parents by providing a pathway for strengthening and restoring their relationships with their children and families. If you're interested in getting involved off in the Angel Tree, we are looking for churches that is willing to partner with Prison Fellowship. The parents would normally sign their children up during the Christmas time, and then the churches come alongside. And so they set all that up with the caregiver. And then when they bring the gifts to the children, and they like, who's this from? Man, it's from your mom. It's from your dad. And then they able to receive the written note that came from the parents. And so it really touches and resonates their heart, because they thinking, dad and mom did not forget about me. They still love me. They still care for me. They took enough time just to write a letter and send a gift to me. Man, I can't wait till my mom and dad come home. Oh, I can't wait till I see him. So that's Angel Tree program. It serves and meets the needs and really connects the children with their parents and serve the caregivers as well.
This is Where You're From. I'm Rasul Berry. And remember, it's not just about where you're at. It's also about where you're from. This show was produced by Ryan Clevenger and Mary Jo Clark. I also want to thank listeners Carl Cranich and Nick Hyde for their help in supporting and promoting Where You're From. Thanks, y'all. Where You're From is part of the Voices Collection from Our Daily Bread Ministries.